Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the No Film School podcast. You've got me, Jason Hellerman, here hosting today. Gigi's still in Panama shooting her masterpiece, and Charles is off in the world testing more cameras and lenses. Today we have a very special guest. He is writer, director, producer Chris Sparling. You might remember him from a little movie in 2010 called Buried, starring Ryan Reynolds, which I feel like set the world on fire. More recently, Greenland, which was a huge hit and has a sequel coming up. So, Chris, welcome to the No Film School podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming here. You know, Chris and I have kind of a funny backstory. When I was in graduate school at Boston University, Chris came and was a guest speaker in my screenwriting class. And I feel like I probably asked him a lot of dumb questions, which I'll reiterate today and have back. But he was kind of an inspiration at the time. Chris is a writer who is currently not living in Los Angeles, but has had huge success kind of tacking and believing in himself and writing his own spec scripts, finding people to do it, and, you know, both writing, directing, and producing. And now we're just so excited to have you here, Chris. And honestly, for me, just to get to talk to you 10 years later in my own career as well is kind of a special treat.
Well, it's like I said, it's good to be here. When you told me that story that we had met before, I was like, no way. Because I remember distinctly that thing where I came in and spoke to the class and everything else. And yeah. That was a kind of crazy time. I mean, that was like, you know, as you probably know, and a lot of the listeners know, there's like a really unique period where you feel like you've broken in, right? And you try so long to just reach that point, and then all of a sudden you do. And it's like, holy cow. Like if you say in that, say using that scenario as an example, like, I don't know, if it'd been 6 months earlier or a year earlier, you guys wouldn't have invited me to come talk to your class. I mean, you would have no interest in me at all. You know, so, and you know, and it's good to hear that 10 years later, you know, you're still doing it. You're still fighting the fight. And here we are.
Exactly. I mean, it all comes back to just continuing writing. And that's something I think even when you spoke that I always admired, but you were just like, you know, coming up with Buried. We don't have to go full into it, but I just remember you talking about, you know, what's an idea I can make? What's a small idea? What's something that feels achievable? And you know, I think all of your specs and all the movies that have come out since, it's interesting. Like every time I watch them, I'm like, oh yeah, I fully see how this puts together. And I don't know if that's part of your director brain or producer brain as well that's coming in, but maybe just talk about the origin of, you know, you, I guess, fair to say, broke in with Buried and then kind of rode that success, but continued to write specs after that.
Yeah, you know, it's something recently that dawned on me, and this hasn't been 100% across the board with all of the things I've written since, is I have a tendency to kind of limit my POV with a lot of the movies I do. You know, it's Buried's obviously the most drastic example of that, but even say you mentioned Greenland, I mean, we're still just following one family. I mean, obviously, we're not. I mean, the antagonist, I guess, in that movie is the actual comet, but we're not checking on, say, like what the military is doing, say, a la Armageddon or whatever else, or Deep Impact.
Yeah, like you don't have like the president's daughter is not a character. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I kind of had, and again, this isn't uniform across everything I've done, but in some ways it's helpful, but in other ways it's hard. You know, if I catch myself doing it now, I'm like, hang on a minute, like you can see what other people are doing in this world. And because stick to the lens. I mean, I think it makes it more personal. That's, I mean, speaking to maybe a director brain and, you know, specifically an indie director brain, it just keeping it somewhat contained and keeping it kind of through the keyhole, if you will, like the view that you're seeing everything in, it does. It makes a movie like Greenland cost $35 million instead of, I don't know, $150 to $200 million.
Yeah, exactly. When you sit down to write, are you a big outliner? Are you writing treatments? Or like, what's the process like for you?
Yeah, definitely that. So I'll start with just, like you, I'm sure, like just kind of walk around with ideas for a while and kind of just test them. If they stick around, they're usually pretty good. So then from there, I'll start fleshing it out, just kind of write like a 2 or 3 page outline of what the movie could be. And if I'm done with that, I'm like, all right, that's pretty good. That's worth continuing on. I will. And from there, usually just kind of create a beat sheet. And if, yeah. at the end of that, if it's like, hey, man, this is something, there's something here for sure. You know, from there, then I'll go full in on it and really start to do the work. And so quite honestly, I'll do a full on step outline every scene in the movie before I start actually even opening, you know, final draft.
Amazing. How do you, are you ever like, one of the problems I find myself with sometimes, the best problem ever to have, right, is that you have two of those outlines. How do you pick what to tackle first? Or, you know, is there like, this is more commercial, so always lean this way. You know, what's your process there?
I mean, it's obviously part of that is if you have reps, you know, that's going to be part of the conversation is talking to them about which, I mean, I wouldn't rely entirely on that. That's discount how important it is to maybe get, you know, because they have their finger on the pulse more so than I do in terms of like what's in the marketplace. And it's not so much a matter of what people are looking for. I think that's kind of a fool's errand. And I don't think a good rep would send you on that errand anyway, but it's, I think it's more a matter if there's an oversaturation of something, if there is, and on top of it, they'll have a sense of to say like, what really all they're going to do is kind of put you in the best position to succeed. It's not to say you shouldn't just follow what you're most passionate about, because ultimately you might do that anyway. I think they could just give you a pretty accurate lay of the land in terms of what you're, you know, what lane is going to be higher chance of success than maybe another. And that's, you know, that's if you're lucky enough to have reps. If you're not, I would say it's a couple things. I mean, I spoke of the passion. I mean, whatever can really motivate you to get into that chair every day and bang out those pages. If there's something real, a real fire in you, that's the story you want to tell. And secondly, you've heard this from other people as well, and I completely subscribe, is that if you know, if you have a great ending, and if you distinctly and clearly know what the ending of a, say you have like three ideas, and one of them is like, this is how this movie ends, that's a huge benefit. Because I think so often it's, people kind of start, they go on the journey, and they really don't know where they're going. And some people can operate in that fashion. Some people can just operate, you know, it's almost like doing the trapeze or the tightrope without a net. You know, I'm not that person. I need to know. I need that net. I need to know. I know where I'm going. So I think for me, as far as like any kind of means test, it's really that straightforward.
Yeah. One thing I think we touched on earlier is, you know, going off the fire and passion. Obviously you've sold stuff, you've had things made. I'm sure you're doing assignments in between, but how do you keep the passion for continuing to spec out your own ideas? You know,
well,
like everyone is a little bit of a lottery ticket.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier that I don't live in LA or New York, and I frankly never have, except for when I started in the industry the very beginning as an actor, and I lived in LA for 2 years. That was the only time I've lived in LA, barring a 6 month period I was directing a movie out there. So, I mean, I've been in Rhode Island this whole time. And so, which was quite frankly was kind of interesting with COVID, where everything became us on Zoom and Skype and everything else. And yeah, and I've been doing that. Yeah, I've been doing that largely for a number of years. Naturally, I would take trips out all the time, but most of my experience was either by phone or by before it was Skype. So anyway, to your question about why I spec, that's part of it, honestly, is that I feel like, you know, I've been doing this for, I mean, 13 years, you know, in terms of if you want to say professionally, as it is my profession, you know, so it's still important, I think, because I'm not there. I feel like it's almost my obligation, my duty to, even though I am doing assignments, I am lucky enough to be working consistently. It's no different than say if you owned a business in a small town, like you would spend the money to put the billboard on Main Street. So you remind people you're still in business, right? And that you're open for business. So it's kind of like that for me is that every year I at least want to write a spec, if not two, just to kind of get it back into the pipeline, just get it into the bloodline.
I love that metaphor, billboard on Main Street, because I do think, it's funny, we have so many listeners from across, honestly, across the world. And you want, it's like you're sending a reminder. Like, you know, you get those Christmas cards every year and you're like, oh, I forgot I knew these people.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah,
great
yeah.
to know they have the Christmas. Like that sort of holiday card thing. It does feel like it's a reminder you're out there and that you still, you know, can craft a story. And I also think, you know, the nice thing about a spec is it's not just an email being like, hey, I still exist, but hey, here's material that could, you know, make all of us money, which
I
do think at some point is everything. How do you balance coming back to LA? COVID was such a weird time. You know, everyone did everything on Zoom. But do you find yourself coming like multiple times a year, or do you just block out, hey, I'll be here for this amount of time? Or?
I'm going to be taking a trip in the near future back out. But it was a 3 year period that I wasn't there during COVID. Last February was the first time I'd been back in 3 years, and which was interesting because I had, I mean, you being there and everyone listening who lives there would know better than I, but all I kept hearing was like, well, don't come yet, because no one's doing meetings, you know, so I kept pushing it off. And until finally, it was like, yeah, people are finally getting together, doing meetings in person and everything else, because the last thing I wanted naturally was to come out there and end up doing Zoom meetings from a hotel. That was absolutely would be absurd. So yeah, I mean, it's been a crazy past couple of years with this industry, you know? So,
yeah. You mentioned, you know, for 14 years, obviously you've seen market changes, you know, from, mm-hmm. you know, what the indie films look like in 2010 versus, you know, now you're kind of, I mean, Greenlight's such an, it's, well, I feel like, hey, I hate saying this, but it's like, it's an international movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can watch it anywhere and have a connection. And it does feel like it becomes like a global story, even though you're just following, you know, one family, one place or two places really, you know? So like, what are the big changes that you've seen happen in your career? And, you know, any ways that I think, you know, how did you face it down, or how do you know what's coming around the corner, or how do you write to anticipate it?
I don't know if I do as much as I think for me, quite honestly, and I don't think I'm alone in this, is that I feel like when you, again, just to use the cliche term of break in, when you break in, it's that is what you break in as, or that's who you break in as. And for me, it was, all right, you wrote this successful movie about a, you know, guy buried alive, and for a whole movie. And so I became early on like the go-to guy for that sort of movie, for contained thriller or whatever else.
Right. Because you went to ATM after that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right. And it was interesting, and I've told this story more than once, but it's the God's honest truth. I remember being at the Toronto Film Festival with Buried and being at some party, and no fewer than two people, maybe three, came up to me, producers who were kind of pitching me, because at the time there was, if you recall, obviously a long time ago, but there were those Chilean miners that were stuck underground. Yeah. Right, right, right. And each different producer had their own way into that story and had whatever rights, and they started like talking to me. And I was like, man, when did I become the authority on people trapped underground? But it made sense. Amazing. I mean, that's how ridiculous this industry can sometimes be in terms of what you get pigeonholed as. And
yeah.
So anyway, it was, and it continues to be to this day, is that I have to kind of always fight that image that I'm not only that writer or that person, you know, that only does those small movies. And so that's the other purpose, I think, about the specs, you know, is that it's not so much me anticipating where the market's going as much as anticipating or directing where I want my career to be going. And so it's almost like reinventing myself. It's like, okay, now I'm going to do a drama with Sea of Trees, and or now I'm going to do a bigger movie with, you know, with Greenland or with whatever. You know, it's like I'm constantly trying to pump out new material that shows another side to what I do. And sometimes I go back to the well. I mean, I don't mind at all. I mean, I like contained movies personally. I think they create really interesting kind of narrative challenges, but nevertheless, I think that's all part of it. It's not about, for me anyway, anticipating as much as just saying, right, this is where I fucking want to go and be.
Yeah. Over the past decade or so, you know, obviously you're a professional writer. Did your habits change at all when, you know, after breaking in and then working for so long? Or were there things you were like, you used to do that you don't do anymore, or things that you adopted that now you do all the time?
Yeah, I think the nature of climbing the ladder affects that a little bit. You know, first of all, like when you're just starting off, you know, I remember trying to go after every assignment under the sun. Like anything that, you know, might have been floated past me by my reps, I'd be like, yep, yeah, I'm gonna go after. And you become like a dog chasing cars after a while. And
absolutely. You know, oh yeah, you get pretty fire. Yeah.
And like you start to realize at a certain point, it's like, okay, first of all, how many of these are even real? Just starting there. And then it's a matter of like, all right, you can't go after all of them and expect to do good work on all of them. And then the nature of what that even entails. I mean, that's like you doing a ton of work potentially for free. So it's a lot of time at no major benefit if you don't get the job. And yeah, most likely at the earlier part, when I talk about that ladder, when you're in the lower rungs of that ladder, it's probably you and a bunch of other writers kind of doing that bake-off. So, you know, as you move on in your career, and I've been very fortunate to be able to climb higher on that ladder, you know, you recognize, or it's not necessary to go after every single one, and that pool of writers you're up against becomes smaller, and so on and so forth. So that's the, you know, the climbing of that ladder in a certain way informs how I've approached, yeah, the, you know, my career at this point versus say 10, 12 years ago or 13 years ago. you know, just a different, there's also just getting older. I mean, I'm at the age I'm at now. It's, you know, I have two kids now. It's like different interests. I'm not as much as I love doing what I do. And I really work hard at it to this day. It's, you do recognize at a certain point, it's like, it's not the end all be all in life. You know, your priorities start to kind of end up in different places. But that all being said, I still treat it like basically a 9-to-5 job. I mean, it's, and that's, you know, you talk about maybe what the pros and cons are of not living in a place like LA. A pro is that I'm able to get a lot of work done because everyone around me, my friends, my family, they're not in the industry. They work regular jobs. So I may as well go work a regular job schedule. So as a result of that, you know, I'm writing a lot. Because what else am I going to do otherwise? You know, my kids are in school. Yeah. My friends are at work. You know, my wife's busy and she's working. So it's like, well, I may as well like just
give it. I love that.
Everything. Yeah. So that really hasn't changed, except maybe as I've gotten older, I've been maybe shaving off the 9-to-5 to maybe like 10-to-3. You know,
sure. Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
I don't remember. I've told this story on the podcast before, but if I have, it was enough episodes ago that people enjoy. But I remember distinctly in 2014, after Shovel Buddies had been on the blacklist and you do the water bottle tour and suddenly you're pitching on everything. And I was saying yes to everything because you want to get a job. And also, like you said, you don't know any better. You're like, sure, I'll come up with that. And I was at this coffee shop on La Brea, which isn't there anymore, Graffiti Cafe. And I go in and I get my cup of coffee and it's packed. So I'm walking around looking to see who's going to be, you know, where to sit. And I realize I'm like around the corner from the production company and on 5 to 10 laptops, our pitch documents all for the same. It was an iPhone game adaptation. Everyone in there had the exact, and you could tell like, oh, they're spending the whole day hearing pitches. I was always like, oh, what a fun thing. My pitch is at 11:15 in the morning. No, every 15 minutes, they were definitely cycling someone in. And I just look and I just started recognizing some of the writers, just like, just from Twitter or honestly, like bigger, you know, more A-list writers. And I remember getting to, I think it was maybe Chris McKay at the end. And I see, and it's, he's got like distinctive tattoos. And I had seen him do like a talk for Greatest Greener Man. And I was like, oh no, like I'm not only not going to get this. There's like 30 other guys, like maybe 5 other guys and gals who are at the exact same level as me. Then 5 people who are like definitely higher up. Then, you know, definitely a couple A-list people. And I just sat down and I went in, I thought the pitch went well. Maybe the next day on deadline, it was like Chris McKay attached to right. Like, all right, that's 100%. And I think it was just like that sort of fun cafe experience that I realized at the time. I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to get, you know, this is what it is. You have to find, yeah. Like now I ask my rep all the time, like how many people are going, you know, is this going to be a huge thing? Is it between me and other people? How can, and then also functionally, like, what do I really care about?
Sure.
Like, I think if I look back, like that iPhone game, I don't think I had a huge emotional connection, you know, and that wasn't part of the hook I had.
When you started to tell that story, I thought you were going to talk about, which something I find to be the most amazing kind of LA only, I think, experience is that when you see people, because I mean, I've been the person too, that walks into, say, a cafe or a restaurant for a meeting.
Yeah.
And you see that look on someone's face when they go around asking, are you so-and-so? No. Or someone will come up to you if you're sitting down and they're meeting with somebody else.
Always.
And it's such a unique thing. I've never seen that anywhere else. About it's just, I don't know. That's where I thought you were going.
It's only in LA. I just love coffee shop culture. And honestly, my dog is so old that at times I can't look at him while I write. But I was at a coffee shop maybe, I guess, Monday of this week. And at least 3 people came up to me and were like, are you so-and-so? And I was like, I'm not, I don't know what this guy looks like. And he came in, he was much taller, you know? Yeah. But
no, I'm not your meeting.
It's an LA only experience. Yeah.
But I've been the person on the other side too, which is so awkward, is to kind of have to look around the place, walk up to people. Are you so, I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you having your breakfast. But anyway, we were saying about seeing people that they're all kind of pitching on the same thing. You recognize after a certain time, right? It's like, this is kind of crazy. And then I talked before too about what's real and what's not too, is that, because that's the unfortunate part of this, is that sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a kind of a fishing expedition, right? Where it's some company might think they have an idea, but they're not quite sure what it is. And so they figure, well, let's just put it out there and see what people come back with. And if nothing, they don't come back with anything, well, nothing venture, nothing gain. Which is, quite honestly, you know, as the whole AI thing is upon us, that is a very specific area that I'm, I don't know if interested is the right word, but I'll use it, interested to see how it plays out. Because everything I just described become very much the function of AI at this point.
Yeah.
And I, honestly, I don't know. Does that mean on our side as well? It's like, let's say you're a young writer and you want to pitch on all those jobs because it's like, hell, I want to go after every single one.
Yeah.
Is it going to be that you just come up with your take using AI so that you can, in a volume basis, go for all of them? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's, I, shit like that scares me, quite honestly.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, this is not, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but I was talking to an unnamed exec who was saying he just, you know, has an overall at a big streamer, and they had sent him, let's say, like, here are the 15 topics we find get the most clicks and watch throughs. And it was topics like, you know, mountain climbing, like, you know, like, or, you know, like lost at sea, things that are like, they're not log lines, but they're also like, you know, he knew it was felt like a directive, right? Go find, you know, if you're bringing us projects, here's 15, you know, generic things that are, you know, what we're looking for. And it's so different than a mandate, right? Because he's like, well, this is a Tuesday in March, you're sending this to me. What's this algorithm look like? You know, like, can I just bring you good stuff? Because who knows what this will look like in the summer, or what the cultural, you know, I think people watch things at different times. And I do think there is that worry I always have of AI that, because everything's pretty similar, like the best use we've seen, best use, and I use that very loosely, of AI is like aggregating content, right? It's like becoming Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. If you become Wikipedia for ideas, everything's going to be just a shade similar. So if you are the writer who's pumping out whatever 35 log lines based on the stuff you get sent and other people are doing it, it feels like the only way to differentiate yourself, hopefully, is going to be coming up with something. But then I'm always worried, you're coming up with something. We've all watched the same movies and TV. Who's to say AI is not going to exactly creep up on it? But
I don't know.
Are the existential worries. Yeah. We need the comet. Yeah.
We need the comet to reset everything.
Exactly. One thing, you know, specs, I always find to be fascinating. You know, I think I probably prescribe to the same thing. I try to write at least one a year, two if I feel really good. During COVID, I wrote 5 in 1 year because I had truly nothing to do, which I think drove my rep at the time insane. And I was just like every 2 months, I was like, here's another one. I don't even go to the grocery store. But specs also, you know, I feel like almost every year there's a news story, you know, well, even like Michael Mann's Ferrari this year. Let's take that for example. The writer has been dead for a few years. It was a spec that I think was written in the 70s or 80s that just lived because it was good and someone found it. So specs have this unusual shelf life, right? Like if it's a timeless story or it could always be updated. I think Tony Gilroy's Beirut was one of those things that like sold in the 80s and came back to him. And then they, you know, it was a John Hamm movie 3 or 4 years ago. So you know, when you're writing and taking stuff out, I think the norm used to be like you take stuff out on a Friday and if you didn't hear anything by Monday, everyone would be sad or you'd hope to be the weekend read. Now it feels like things are taking longer. So how do you, I guess, manage your expectations when you're going out with a new spec? And then also, you know, how do you keep a spec alive until it's, I guess, if it's ever dead, you know, or is it ever dead?
It's interesting because I've seen both. You know, I just went out with a spec, it was, I guess, about less than a year ago now that I sold to Legendary. And I saw, and I want to say that was the first time that it happened as fast as it did for me, you know, to see what you described, like over the weekend, you know, the bidding war starts and then that you have so much heat on something and it happens so fast. But I've also had many times where it's like there's heat on a project, but just watch it. It just kind of slowly takes time and it doesn't go at the speed you want it to. And obviously it's discouraging, but it doesn't die. It doesn't really die in the vine as much as it just takes time and it takes the right people to come on board and to really shepherd it forward. It's not as clean of a process, I guess, as, sure, you know, it's just say, oh, you write a spec, you sell it. Great. Terrific. Can't beat that. But it's still obviously at the end, if it works out, it's a rewarding thing, but sometimes it takes long. I mean, I had a Netflix movie that I produced with Josh Weinstock and Alexander Milchan for Netflix. And we brought on a great director, Adam Salke, and this was like a year and a half ago now, a year ago. And that was a project that for 7 or 8 years, that was a spec that I'd been trying to get made. And it had gone through the different permutations and everything else, and it had been in all these different places. And you think it's dead, but as long as, I mean, I heard a great expression recently, is someone described it as like, in looking at the projects that you have, right? Is it, well, let me get this right. I'll probably fuck it up the first time, so forgive me. It was like, is it too strong to die, or am I too weak to kill it?
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's so true on the feature side, I think, because I feel like the television side, that kind of gets answered for you faster or more definitively.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, but on the feature side, it really does seem like they're, you kind of have to be very honest with yourself at a certain point on a project. But that said, you don't know. I mean, it only takes one. That's, you know, it only takes one
right
to come along and say, hey, this is, we want to do this. And you're like, fuck, where were you 7 years ago?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The nature of specs, it's so funny, you know, because so much of it is, you know, I'll say the word packaging, right? It's like, we need to meet a director. We need to meet the right producers, actors. When you're chatting with the, you know, you've got a new spec and you're chatting with different production companies at all at the same time or different directors all at the same time, how do you pick who's right? Is it just to go with the gut feeling? Obviously, you can call around and talk to people, but, you know, what's the impetus or what's your process when figuring that out?
I think it depends on the project. I have a project that is set in and around the Nobel Prize. And for me, getting a either Swedish or Norwegian filmmaker was very important to me. And we were lucky enough to do that because I feel like, you know, having an understanding of that part of the world intimately and even say about the Nobel and everything behind it. So I think that's maybe a more specific and sort of thing. But other times, I mean, again, it's kind of you, if you're meeting with director for a project, it's not one I'm going to do. It's like, you want to find someone who really understands the vision of the project. And naturally you have to, you know, again, this is something you learn with time, is that as a writer, it's like you have to be willing to kind of let go to a certain extent. But if you can manage to maintain a seat at the table, which I think writers should really try to do as much as they can, because it's, you know, it is difficult to completely give up control. And,
absolutely,
you know, so if you do still have a seat at the proverbial table, then I think someone that understands the movie you wrote is important. Even if it's not the movie you wrote, they understand right what you were trying to do here, right? I think that's key. And then naturally, just what, you know, it's like anything, be it a director, producer, whatever, you're putting together a team. I mean, and you want to find people that you can be in the trenches with, because it's going to be a long time.
Is there, when you're writing a script and you know you want to direct it, right? You're writing it for yourself. Is there a different way you put it on the page versus if you're writing it, you know, to be a spec that goes wide?
No, I think I kind of have an understanding of like, this one's for me, this one's not for me. Because clear, I've directed two movies at this point. I know a movie like the one I mentioned before that I sold to Legendary. Chances are I'm not going to get the crack at that. It's just too big. There's too much money on the line. And, you know, I mean, I get it. I understand. This is a lot of money at stake here. So comes to something smaller and something I really feel like I have a handle on and a vision for, it's going to be something that I push for. Now, having said that, there have been more than a few times where I was lined up to direct something that I stepped off directing because, you know, you talked before about like the things you have to do and the team you have to put together to get a movie made. And sometimes it requires that. And we required that right out of the gate with Buried. I mean, that was the first thing that had to happen, is that, so I was going to direct Buried. The first thing that was asked of me is like, you know, would you be willing to step back with it and go out with it as a spec? You know, find a director and everything. And I said, yeah, I mean, naturally at that point, it was kind of an easier decision because I just wanted to, again, just break in. But there have been projects along the way where it's like, all right, this is one I was going to direct, but look, we've gone down that road and we've, you know, I've met with actors and everything else, but it just didn't come together. And I could have kept trying and trying, but sometimes you realize, all right, let's pivot, let's do something else. And that's happened, and to success a couple times, sometimes not.
Yeah, I feel like it is always a dice roll, but you know, you've got to, anything to get the movie made,
yeah, right?
Anything to get it on screen, you know, whatever it takes. One big thing we always talk about, I think it's something that always gets kicked around in almost every interview we do, is just the idea of writer's block. You know, do you think it's real? Do you get it? How do you get through it? Is it just an act two problem? You know, how do you take it?
I think there's no such thing as writer's block to a certain extent. Sure. Because if you're saying that you just can't write, you're in front of the computer, you don't know what to write. That's bullshit, because it can be disproven quite easily. Because if you just then flip over to your email, you can go write an email. You know, you can go text your mom. It's just, at the end of the day, it's coming down to you have writer's block, called writer's block, because you're afraid of writing shit. You know, you're afraid, yeah, of writing poorly and being judged for it. You know, you don't feel, you're not afraid of being judged by your mom when you text her, you know, unless your mom's like,
absolutely,
I don't know, maybe you are. Maybe your mom really judges you the way you write your text, but
it's the grammar.
Yeah, exactly. But like, by and large, it's like, if you email a friend, you're not like, oh, I really need to think and rethink what I'm writing here. So there's no block. It's that's the proof that there's, in that moment, you're not blocked from writing. However, I will say that I think there is something to be said about like struggling to come up with ideas. I think there is some sort of mental treadmill that we all end up on eventually. And we realize, like, I just keep recycling the same idea. I don't mean like from movie to movie or script to script. I mean, even within the same one, we are kind of like, if I'm trying to come up with an idea for what I want to write next, let's say, and it's like, well, okay, maybe it's a movie about this. And it's like, you know, it's like, I'm just kind of doing the same movie, or like, I need. I think there is an element of that. And it's not to say it doesn't happen at all in the course of writing a script where you feel like I'm kind of on that treadmill too. But in terms of the inability to write, that's just bullshit, because you can't. And I mean, that's the way you get through it. You have to just power through it. If you get out of your own way and power through it, be okay with the fact that you're probably going to write some garbage mixed in, but you need to get through it. I found over time, what's helpful is just to write asterisks. Just put an asterisk. Yeah. If you don't know what the character says, it's like, yeah, okay, this one says this. And then you're like, I don't know. But they'll say something, but you want to keep moving forward. Yeah. You know, and even to say sometimes the scene description, it's like, yeah, there's probably, like sometimes it's like you want to say it in a slightly, you know, read something a way that reads a little better. And
yeah, a cinematic description.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And maybe you're just not coming to you at that moment, but you know what you want. So write it in the fucking terrible way and put some asterisk next to it. So you can just then go back to the beginning and control F asterisks and just go back.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I think even just in my own process, a lot of times I'll write, you know, like interior, whatever. And I'll be like, Chris and Jason are in a room. This needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Dialogue. I know what the next scene is, you know, and then hopefully you catch that before you send it in, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Right.
Well, your man, right. I'll be like, I love it. On page 45, it's pretty stark. It's just, they have a conversation about something, you know? But yeah, the asterisk is a good idea. I think I love a good find and replace version. But one another big thing we talk about, and maybe this will be our last big question, is just pitching. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're pitching, do you have strategies? Do you write it out? How do you enter a pitch? You know, aside from like, I prepare, like what's your preparation process and how do you tackle each one individually?
It depends. I mean, that's actually been one benefit about, again, not being in LA and being here. I've pitched a lot of times over Skype in the past, and then it was during, you know, obviously Zoom, and it continues to be largely Zoom since, is that you can have your notes in front of you and it looks like you're looking at the person. It depends, really. I mean, you try to do an advanced read the room sort of situation, I think, where it's like, all right, is this going to be something that I really need to drill down? But I have found over time, less is more when it comes to pitches. And some people listening might totally disagree, and they may be totally right, and I may be totally wrong. But I'm just telling you, in my experience, less is more. I've done the thing where I've done the so fucking detail, especially early on in my career. And you can see, you know, God bless them, the executive sitting there, and you know, like they're glazing, their eyes are glazing over. They're probably getting warm because they're so like uncomfortable because it's like, oh my God, this guy's still talking. So I've done that, and that certainly isn't the way to go. You know, some people are really engaging. I mean, I like I said, having an acting background, I'm not afraid to get in front of someone and perform a little, if you will.
Sure. Oh yeah, I did a pitch last year with a stand-up comedian. We had written this thing together, and the hardest thing about pitching was he was so funny that I never knew where we were. I was like just absolutely dying because, you know, he knew it, but he would also riff in the room. And he was so good at that. And then I would look, and then I realized he had tossed it to me, and I'd be like, I mean, we're in Act 2, you know, and you'd look fun in your place. But yeah, absolutely. I totally understand. The performance is real.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it doesn't have to be as big as, like you were saying, your stand-up comedian friend that you were doing the project with either. It's just a matter of being comfortable in the room. Nothing makes other people more awkward than if you're awkward and nervous. I mean, that just, I mean, it's something about, I don't know, our nature. It just makes us very uneasy if other people are uneasy around us. And so being able to kind of be at ease, and one way to be at ease is to just, I think, not to really go too far into the details of things, you know, the broader strokes with a couple set pieces. And, you know, and this is quite honestly, the you know, I've heard it described this way. I'm sure you have and other people listening have. It's just like, describe it like you're describing a movie you just saw to a friend.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can do that, I think you're in a good place. I mean, and, you know, that's that we're talking about feature pitches on the TV side. It's going to be a different animal as well.
Yeah.
You have more to describe there. But at the end of the day, people's capacity for listening to maybe a stranger or a relative stranger talk to them and then have to go do it again and again, I think it's quite limited ultimately. And I think you're helping them by keeping it on the briefer side.
I you know, came to Los Angeles. I was an assistant. I was at Scott Free. And then I worked for Michael Costigan when he was at Sony and went over. And, you know, we were hearing 3 or 4 pitches a week. And I always think back, I'm like, I don't know why I didn't learn more lessons from that. But I was like, you see the broad spectrum of like the people who can pitch and the new people. And then I still remember breaking in my first pitch, went like 45 minutes and I was drenched in sweat. And afterwards, the exec was like, you really ran a marathon there. Like, just so you know, next time you could just like, you could have told us the beginning and the end, we would have been happy.
Right.
You know, like that sort of, you know, and then I, you know, I saw that guy at a party years later and he was like, I tell everybody about your pitch. And I was like, yeah, I know it's not a good way because you didn't buy it, you know, but it is that sort of thing. I remember Michael was always so good in the room of just calming people down. So now I think either way, like, when I'm talking to executives, I always feel, you know, if they're calming people down or they're like, oh, we're so excited, you know, and they have that sort of parental voice.
Yeah.
That's where I find some ease to it. But it is, I do think it's such a different art form or a different beast that you do just have to do it a bunch to learn how you'll do it the best, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And that's, and two things to kind of piggyback on what you just said. One is, especially again, when you're starting out, is like most likely you've worked in other jobs, non-industry jobs. And think about that experience. It's like when you're going for a job interview, it's a very formal experience. You know, you're sitting most likely kind of more, a little more upright in your chair, you're dressed, you know, kind of very sharply and blah, blah, blah. And then your answers are very, you're trying to find, speak perfectly. And that's kind of what you're trained to do. And now all of a sudden you're thrust into this, what you view as like, well, this is kind of me going for a job, right? Like, there's this sense of like, and understandably, it's like, well, okay, I need to be overly prepared and I need to be like everything down to the letter. And when our industry is really unique in that way, it's not that you want to go in and put your feet on the desk, but like, it's a relaxed atmosphere. And the more relaxed you can make that atmosphere, the better. You know, it's the exact, yeah. It is the opposite of every other, I mean, not every other, as far as I know, but like most familiar job application, if you will, experiences or job interview experiences. And then the second one was what you just said was, I think it is important to rehearse it, like to actually, to because you'll start to realize how many, like, not just ums and blah, it just becomes, you realize, all right, I really don't need to drone on for that long about this. I can get, hearing it out loud, if you want to record yourself.
Yeah.
It's good. It is good to do it, to literally like do it and practice it a couple times before you actually do it.
I'm a big recorder of myself for pitches only. I was clearing out my iPhone the other day and found all these notes of all these pitches I had recorded just for time. But I do think, you know, Zoom has weirdly made it easier because you can have that document. It's canceled out many of my ums and errs because I find the document so much and then record it and refine and cut that it definitely has taken it to another level. And I think execs like it because they don't have to watch you be drenched in sweat across them.
Right,
you
know, right. Like,
awkward waiting room. I'm not running into anybody. It is always fun. But yeah, those pitches are. And I had one disastrous pitch. Went up working out. I was pitching I thought the idea was supposed to be like an R-rated hangover style trip through Europe. And what they wanted, it turns out, was like a family movie. Mm-hmm. And I was halfway through the pitch, like describing a scene where they're trying to get drugs out of a camel and they're like reaching into a camel's butt. Uh-huh. And I remember everyone was laughing. It was the first time I felt like, no, this is early on maybe 2015, maybe even earlier. And it was the first pitch I did, but I was like, oh, I'm doing this correctly. And I am crushing in this room. And everyone's dying. And the exec's like, just stop. And I thought because he was laughing so hard. He was like, this is one of the best pitches we've ever heard, but this is nowhere. This is supposed to be like a PG family. I don't know where that wire came across. Like, and if, you know, we found like the email where someone had said adult comedy, but what they meant was young adult. You know, it's like a very funny thing. And they just stopped me halfway, and it was brutal to be stopped halfway while crushing. But we wound up working together on a project like a month later. So it did work out. They're like, we do have something in the pipeline. But it was, I will say, like, pitching is that unique art form where it's not always the job you go into pitch that you're going to get either. You know, it's just because you're showing them you're a normal person or that you're fun to be around or whatever it is. And that was, I remember that was like a Thursday, and I was so humiliated all weekend. And by Monday, they had called my reps and been like, we would love to find something else. Like, what else does he have? And we wound up working together on this horror comedy that I had that sort of fit the bill. But it is, you know, that kind of thing that kind of drives me crazy.
Well, and then it,
but it is,
bad. But it's also important. And we touched upon it earlier. It's like, it's kind of an unsung aspect of our business. And it's like just being a normal person, being someone that people can be around is a huge thing. And I don't know, like, I don't, maybe there are that many crazy people in our industry, but it's like, it's nuts how important that is. And if you tell people that, they look at you like, what are you, of course you have to be a normal person. You can't be a nut, like, crazy. I don't know. Like, see, it's a very valuable thing to just, because I mean, especially when you're talking about really getting to work with someone, it's like, if this is not an overnight thing, if you're going to work with someone on a project, it's going to be a lot of time together. And if you butt heads, if you're difficult, if you're awkward and weird and not a normal person, I don't know, you could be really talented. That might be enough for me to be like, just life's too short, man. I don't want to.
Yeah. I have enough friends who are executives who give me that secondhand. My buddy yesterday was telling me they had someone come in and pitch Upside Down. And he was like, it was supposed to be, thought it was like a gimmick, like in the first 10 minutes. And then we were like, this guy's going to lose the blood rushing to his head. You know, like, this is.
Oh, you mean literally he was upside down?
Yeah, he laid on the ground and was like, all right, we're in space. You know, he was like, at one point, I think he was like, we were just like, look, you can turn around. Just, we get the image, you know, you've sold it to us. It is what it is. But it is, I do think it's that fine line, just being a normal person, being easy to work with. I think also, like, so much of Hollywood is, you know, for lack of a better, like, you're stuck in the trenches. You just want to be like, look, if it's 1:30 in the morning and we have to go to Denny's because we've been, you know, like, and you're so tired, we have to break something we're shooting at 7. I just want to know that you're going to, like, order normally and we can hash something out and it's not going to be like a meltdown situation. So yeah. And lastly, I guess, you know, you've been at it for a while. What advice would you have for people who are trying to break in now? Maybe they're writing their first or second spec, or they've got stuff and they're looking for reps. You know, do you have any sort of panacea for the pain of breaking in?
Yeah. I wish I did. I wish I could say, like, this is what you do. I feel like if we wanted exact answers, like, we should have gone into maths and sciences. I mean, I feel like the people that are out there listening that are at that place that are doing what they're doing, it. They're doing the things they need to be doing. They need to be writing. They need to be writing scripts and reading scripts all the time. And then, you know, whether it's like, whether it's trying to get an agent or whether it's trying to, you know, maybe sell a script of theirs or whatever else, it's like, there's something, it's kind of awful, but it's just the nature of the beast. It's like, when you have, it's like blood in the water with sharks, not to make, paint those people as sharks, but there is an element of, like, when you have something people want, all of a sudden, there they are. And you know, and maybe the advice there is, don't lose sight of don't be difficult, I guess, if you find yourself in that fortunate position, which I think everybody will, confident to all you guys, is don't be difficult, but also don't undervalue yourself. And I don't necessarily mean financially, but in terms of, like, something was it Irvin Thalberg early on always talked about the writer as something to the effect of, like, the writer is the most important part, but don't ever let him know that. And I don't understand why that's the case, why there is this sentiment in this industry that, like, writers are, like, I don't know, almost like the Charlie Kaufman adaptation, like, that everyone is that. And I think one thing that was beneficial, and maybe this can be considered advice, is, like, I've been very much like, no, this is me. I'm here. I'm okay. You let me in the room. I'm not going to be a difficult person, but I'm going to make sure I'm part of the process. You know, and it started with Buried. I mean, maybe it was helpful because Buried is very you know, with Rodrigo being such an amazing, not only director, but an amazing guy, and Ryan as well. Like, there was an, and maybe because it was such a small project, there were, it became like this triumvirate. Like, there were the three of us. And with all the press and all of the things, it was the three of us, right? And just about like an ego thing with press, it's more a matter of like, I used the phrase earlier with the seat at the table. Like, it's like, it's important to maintain that, even if it's not to say, like, if you're not a producer, like, just in terms of like, take up some space, you know, like, take up some space in the world and in this industry. It's don't get pushed around. And it's tough. It's really tough early on because you're so grateful to be there because you've tried so hard. And believe me, I'm speaking from experience. Yeah. It took me like 10 plus years to get to that place. And so, like, once you finally are, like, invited into the party, like, the last thing you feel like you want to do is get kicked out. But the way, I mean, as long as you're not a total crackpot or a dick, you're not. As long as you continue to do good work, that's really what people care about. And it's so funny, people in this industry throw around the, oh, I love, oh, we love, oh, Chris, we love Chris. Or, you know, Jason, we love Jason. It's like, that's all nice, but shut the fuck up. Nobody loves anybody. Like, we're all just working together. Exactly. And it's fine. And there's some really nice people and some other people that aren't so nice and some people that fall in between, right? So like what I'm saying is like, don't be afraid to kind of plant your flag early on. And if you do that, it will continue in that fashion. That's what I meant early on where I feel like you are what you are when you break in. And if you are someone who immediately fades into the background, that will be the perception of you. You will get pushed around, or at least it'll seem like it's okay to push you around for a long time because that's how it was. And that's how, who you are. And especially when you couple that with that weird sentiment surrounding writers in the first place. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the, how you kind of articulate that other than my best attempt at it.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Don't get pushed into the back.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for summing it up for me because I was struggling with
it. On this podcast. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're front and center. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for joining us. It was amazing to talk again after 10 years or so. And I'll send a picture to the BU professors and let them know we're both still around. But, you know, it's great. And, you know, if you want to plug anything, now's your time. Well, what do we have coming up?
Oh, well, there's going to be a sequel to Greenland that will start shooting soon. So, I mean, I'm very early in promoting that now by talking about it. But what else? You know, hopefully we get Fast Fight up and running. That's the one at Legendary. And I don't know.
I mean, yeah, all your movies are readily available.
Oh, sorry,
on,
yeah.
On the record.
Yes, all, yeah. Yeah, Two Trees, Buried, Greenland, Intrusion, yeah.
Great. And honestly, I'll say this, and, you know, whatever, we can be friends now, but I just find your scripts to be amazing things to read. You're such a good on-the-page writer, and I think anybody listening, you know, maybe we'll put a link up to Buried or something like that so they can check it out, because I do think Chris's voice is on the page. We talk about voice a lot, and it's not something we can essentially define, but Chris, you're just so good on the page. I know that's a big thing. Sea of Trees too. I just remember reading that and I probably have my coverage somewhere where I was like, this is great.
Oh,
like,
thank you.
You know, so if you're listening, find a Chris Sparling script and read it. I do think you can learn so much more about voice and action and tone, just checking them out. So, you know, look into them and rent and watch the movies too. You know?
Yeah, right on. Well, I appreciate it, Jason, very much.
No problem. Well, thank you again. And this is the No Film School. We're signing off. And thank you again, Chris.
Thank you.